Thank you. I'd like to thank very much the organisers for inviting me to speak and tell you a little bit about some of our recent work. So just a few introductory slides to illustrate the problem that Leishmania parasites have got in terms of transmission, which is that the sandfly is interested in taking a blood meal which is going in that direction, whereas the parasites need to find a way of getting out in the opposite direction. So how do they solve this problem? Well, there's a number of different key factors in the transmission of leishmaniasis, and you've heard about several of these already this afternoon, and the three that are underlined I'm going to talk a little bit about in the next few minutes. That's the escape of the parasites from the perotrophic matrix, the role of promesticate secretory gel in transmission, and manipulation of sandfly behaviour. I'll start with a little description of the promesticate secretory gel, or PSG for short. It's a gel-like material that's secreted by promastigotes and it's found in mature infections, in other words, those that are capable of being transmitted by bite. The main component in this gel is something called filamentous proteophosphoglycan. It's got a long name and it's a very large glycoprotein. And part of the reason it's large, it has many hundreds of these repeats, for example, like this, which are very rich in serine residues. And these serine residues are actually subjects for glycosylation, phosphoglycan disaccharides, galmanfos. Repeating units are actually linked to these serines via a unique form of glycosylation that occurs in Leishmania, of course, phosphoglycosylation. And PSG has a range of interesting biological features, both in the sandfly. It's responsible for creation of the block fly, which is essential for transmission by regurgitation of the parasites. And it's also involved in behavioral manipulation, which I'm going to tell you a little bit about more in a moment. In terms of the mammalian host, we've shown that it's ingested during blood feeding, and it also leads to exacerbation of infection in mouse models. It's found located in the anterior midgut in the mature infections in this position here. This shows a time course. These are days of infection here and accumulation of this very high molecular weight heterodisperse glycoprotein. If we look at transverse section through the esophagus, for example, in a mature infection, you see lots of promastigotes occluding the gut and also through the stomatal valve here. And these are all embedded in this gel-like material. And here shown is a freshly dissected PSG plug. Here's the remnants of the foregut here, and as soon as you dissect this and lift this out of a fly, it expands and increases in volume. So it's present inside the fly at a very high concentration and causing a strong physical blockage within the gut. We had a look at behavioural manipulation, or the possibility of that, for the following reasons. I was intrigued this morning, Alan Warburg, I think, quoted 10% infected Shigenti in a region of Israel. That's very exceptional. Typically, the number of infected sandflies in endemic regions is very low. They're very hard to find an infected fly. So this is generally given rise to the idea that somehow the vectors must be quite efficient at transmitting the disease. So how do they do that? And of course, there could be many explanations for that. One of the possibilities, though, is does the parasite manipulate the feeding behavior of the sandfly to promote its own transmission? And a related question to that is, does the sandfly infection actually have any detrimental effect on the survival or the fecundity of the sandfly host? So we looked first to see what the linkage was between the production of the gel and metacyclogenesis in the parasite, being the two of the key features involved in transmission. And what you see here is a time course of infection in sandflies, and the increase in the numbers of metacyclic promastigotes, the infective form, with time. This is with Leishmania mexicana, and this is with Leishmania infantum, both in Lutzomyelongi palpis. So you can see that in this case, the mexicana parasite develops more quickly than the infantum parasite, and that's parallel with more quick and higher amounts of the gel material produced in the mexicana infections compared to the infantum infections. So maybe that's just a correlation. To test this more rigorously, we can use our ability to grow the mastigotes of Leishmania mexicana azenically. What we find is that if we initiate infection with logarithmic phase domesticates compared to stationary phase domesticates, we get a much more quickly and rapidly developing infection in sandflies. So here's the number of metacyclics in the log phase domesticate initiated infections compared to the stationary phase initiated infections. And you get a similar reflection of the amount of gel produced. Here we get more and earlier appearance of the gel in the log phase infections compared to the stationary phase. Okay, so the two seem to be linked together. What about survival? Well, we've looked at, these are Kaplan-Meier plots showing the mortality of sandflies in the laboratory after blood feeding, and the uninfected flies just fed on a normal blood meal are shown in the black field in triangles. And here you've got Leishmania infantum, Leishmania mexicana infected flies, or Leishmania mexicana log and stationary phase amastigote infected flies. In all cases, the infection leads to a statistically significant enhanced mortality in the flies. So the infection does affect the survival of the females. But interestingly, the number of eggs laid, excuse me, or the larval hatching success isn't affected by the infection. So the flies seem to manage to produce the number of eggs that they were going to produce anyway, but they don't survive so long if they're carrying a Leishmania infection. And this effect is even more pronounced if we also add some stress into the situation. So our stress flies, in this case we chill them for a period, putting them at a low temperature, and we also, a pair of fit people, take a cage and toss it back between each other for about an hour to keep the flies from settling down, so they're forced to fly around the cage for an hour. And if we stress them like this every day, you can see that the effect of the infection here is very considerable in terms of accelerating the mortality of the flies. And the reason we did this was we didn't really know whether our lab conditions were reflecting what's going on in the wild, so we thought maybe conditions out there are a bit tougher, so we had some stress in and we get an even more profound effect. So what we end up with is this sort of interesting balance, which is that if we think about the parasite growing inside the sandfly and what the effect of that may be on transmission, we can on one side consider that maybe faster growth of the parasite will mean more infective stages, more of the gel, and both of those should be factors promoting transmission. On the other side though, it also is going to mean more mortality of the sandflies, and obviously if your host is dead, then you've got zero chance of being transmitted, so this is a bad thing. So sort of a priori, there's no obvious benefit to the parasite of either developing more quickly or more slowly. But irrespective of that, what the parasite has to do is make sure that it's differentiated to the infective stage by the time the sandfly is taking another bite. So it has to complete what's known as its extrinsic incubation period. So does it do this by manipulating the behavior of the fly? And so there's various different things you could think of how the parasite may influence the sandfly behavior. So host seeking, initiation of feeding, response to defensive behavior, etc. These may come into play before the bite or after the bite's taken. So we took a leaf out of the malaria mosquito literature where people have been using a persistence assay. And the way this is set up is you allow your flies, our adaptation of this assay is that we allowed our flies to feed for 1 minute on an anaesthetized mouse. We then interrupted them by gently brushing the antennae of the female, so it then pulls out. And then we allow it an opportunity to begin refeeding. And then if it does that, we disturb it again after 10 seconds and keep on going with this. And we have a timer on this. So our measure of persistence is how long these flies continue to refeed if we continually interrupt their feeding behavior. And what we found is that indeed we do get an increase in sandfly feeding persistence in infected flies, but this only occurs when the infective stages are present. So you've already seen this data. This is the accumulation of metacyclics with time in our two species of Leishmania. And what we see here is this is the feeding persistence in terms of seconds. And you can see the Leishmania mexicana infected flies showing an increase in feeding persistence compared to the controls. This is occurring quite early and reaching a higher level. We also see it in Leishmania infantum, but in correlation with the late appearance of the infective stage in this particular model, again, we only see the persistence coming up towards the end of the infection here. So again, we've got a correlation between the presence of infected stages and feeding persistence. And similar to before, we can test this a little bit more rigorously by using our log in stationary phase AMS to go system. And again, you've seen this before, this is the increase in the number of infected forms, and this is parallel with an increase in the feeding persistence in the log phase versus the stationary phase infected sand flies. This is all very well, but is it actually any use to the parasite? And that's only the case if it leads to an increase in transmission. And we looked at this in two different ways. On the left here, we've got an analysis of looking at the probability of feeding on a second host. So refeeding on the same host is good, but if you refeed on another host, that's even better from the parasite's point of view. So here we have adapted our persistence assay. We put two mice in the cage. So we allow it to start feeding on one. We interrupt it and we ask what's the probability of then feeding on the second mouse in the cage. And we see that in all cases, compared to the uninfected flies, which show very little increase in persistence, in phantom, Mexicana, stationary, and log phase parasites are all showing an increase in feeding on a second host as the infection matures. The second issue is whether it leads to increase in numbers of parasites within the lesions. So here we're comparing our log and our stationary phase parasite-initiated sand flies, either with no interruption or with interrupted feeding, similar to what we're using in the persistence assay. Now, if we don't interrupt them, then the flies can spend as long as they like feeding, and there's no difference. However, if we simulate host defensive behavior and interrupt them, then we get a significant difference between the log phase versus the stationary phase-initiated parasites, parasite infections in the flies. In other words, if we have something that's more akin to what we would anticipate in the real world, where a host is reacting to a sand fly bite, then the more parasites are present, the more gel, they show an increased parasite burden developing in the lesions of the bites resulting from those flies. So the conclusions of this are that Leishmania infection does exact fitness costs on sand flies, and that's expressed as decreased survival, and that these mammalian infected forms, these flies infected with these forms, show increased feeding persistence, and this leads to an increase in transmission. And this correlates with the presence of the gel. And although we've got more work to do on this, our current hypothesis is that the gel, the FPPG, is the actual manipulator molecule that's leading to this decreased blood feeding success. I'll just switch gears to another molecule that we've been looking at, which is chitinase. And this has been proposed as a virulence factor for Leishmania for some time. They secrete this in culture, the promastigote forms, and it can have both potentially negative and positive effects on the development of the parasite. The negative effect is that if there's excess chitinase around, this may compromise the integrity of the peritrophic matrix, and this could lead to increased exposure to trypsin during a mastigote-promastigote transformation. And this idea was originally described by Paolo Pimenta some years ago. However, the peritrophic matrix is a sort of double-edged sword, if you like. Although early on the parasite may benefit from the protective effects of the peritrophic matrix, later on it's actually got to escape from that in order to complete its development in the fly. So the positive role that chitinase may play is assisting escape from the peritrophic matrix before defecation of the blood meal and possible loss of the parasites. And this was a hypothesis originally advocated by Joseph Slime some years ago. And the other possibility we looked at was, does it actually aid transmission of the bite by damaging the stomatal valve, which you saw in some pictures in earlier presentations. And again, this was something that was originally proposed by Schlein some years ago. So there's lots of circumstantial evidence supporting these, but we directly tested this for the first time by using Leishmania mexicana parasites that we transfected with the chitinase gene. In other words, they were overexpressing this enzyme at higher than normal levels, and we looked to see what the effect of that would be. First, we checked that in our system that the chitinase, early expression of chitinase, would have this potential effect on parasite mortality. And the way this was done was by adding in a bacterial chitinase along with the the parasite blood meal, and we're looking a couple of days later at the number of parasites in the flies. What we can see, if we have a control infection here, this is the number of parasites after 48 hours. And if we mix chitinase in with the blood meal, we get a severe reduction in the numbers of parasites. But this can be recovered by adding a trypsin inhibitor, or TI here, and restore the infection back to levels approaching the control. So this is confirming that if the integrity of the peritrophic matrix is compromised at an early stage, that's detrimental to the parasites, and the reason for that is this exposure to trypsin. You can have a similar effect if instead of using whole blood, you use plasma alone as your blood feeding experiment. Because this is lacking the cellular component, obviously the erythrocytes, trypsin can diffuse into the blood meal much more quickly, so you get a strong mortality effect, and again, this can be rescued by adding the trypsin inhibitor into the blood meal. So this is fitting in with the ideas that Paolo Pimenta presented some time ago. So what about the overexpression of chitinase? So now we're dealing with parasites, either control transfections here or with overexpressing the chitinase. And you can see that the first thing you notice is this big drop in parasites between the numbers found initially at time zero versus one day. And this is the mortality due to this trypsin effect. Interestingly, there's no significant difference between the two here. If anything, the chitinase overexpressor is doing slightly better than the control. And we interpret this to mean that in fact, there's not sufficient chitinase expressed by the parasite at this early stage in its development to have any compromising effect on the peritrophic matrix. It obviously wouldn't make much sense for the parasite to damage the thing that's going to protect it at the early stage of the infection, and that seems to be borne out by the data. The parasite then infection recovers, numbers go up, and you can see that the chitinase overexpressors do much better than the controls inside the flies as the infection has progressed. And we specifically looked at the idea that there may be escape from the peritrophic matrix that the chitinase is helping out with here. And so what we're looking at here is the parasite population arriving at the stromatal valve. So there's none there at the beginning, they're all back in the abdominal midgut inside the blood meal. They start to escape after a few days. And we can see the chitinase overexpressors arriving earlier and achieving higher numbers than the control transfectants. So we're actually measuring numbers arriving at the stromatal valve, but our interpretation of the data is that the reason these guys get here earlier is that they've managed to escape from the peritrophic matrix more efficiently. We've also looked at this issue of damage to the stromatal valve, and here's a series of electron micrographs. This one in the top left here is showing a normal blood-fed sandfly, no Leishmania infection. You can see this is the chitin layer of the stromatal valve here and the underlying columnar cells. If we have a fly that's either carrying a wild-type infection or a plasmid control infection, we can see these are parasites here attaching to the stromatal valve via these hemidesmosomal-like structures. That's this little black arrowhead. And you can see that there's little gaps appearing underneath the chitin. In other words, there's evidence of damage to the stromatal valve as a result of the infection. And this sort of data was published some years ago by Schlein. If we look at the overexpressor parasites, then what we see is much more evidence of destruction of the stromatal valve. So lots of remnants of cuticle, a lot of separation between the underlying cells here and the surface layer of the cuticle. So in other words, we're getting much more damage in these chitinase overexpressor parasites occurring to the stromatal valve. And also, we've looked at the feeding time the flies spend in terms of when they're blood feeding. If there's no infection, this is the typical duration we find of blood feeding. An increase in blood feeding duration with flies that are affected with wild type or control plasmid control parasites, and a very significant increase in the overexpressor infected sandflies. In other words, these guys are spending sort of nearly twice as long taking a blood meal compared to the normal wild-type parasites. And the final data slide, again, does it make any difference to the parasites, what's going on in transmission? So here we have the lesions developing as a result of single fly bites by our overexpressor parasite infected flies compared to wild type and the plasmid controls. And this is also reflected in the parasite burdens. Again, the overexpressors generating the highest numbers of parasites in the mice. So the conclusion for this part of the talk is that chitinase is a multifunctional virulence factor for the parasite, and that conclusion is supported by the fact that overexpression of the chitinase resulted in increased survival and growth, earlier colonization of the valve and increased damage to the valve, longer feeding times and increased transmission by bite. So just to finish with some acknowledgements, here are various people in the lab. The ones that have asterisks have departed, and I just want to particularly mention Matt Rogers, who was instrumental in a lot of the work that I've described just now. And also two external collaborating labs. So the work on chitinase I've just been talking about was done in collaboration with Peter Wolf's lab in Prague and Dennis Dwyer's lab in NIH. Not to forget the people that pay the bills, so this has been supported by the Wellcome Trust. Thank you very much. Yes, that's what we think. So the question is, which stage in the life cycle is producing the promasticate secretory gel? Now, we don't think it's the metacyclase. We think it's the stage preceding that, which will be the haptomonad stage in your nomenclature, or what we've named the leptomonad stage, or short leptomonads. So these are short parasites that are occluding the valve, that are present in the gel. They're the majority population, and it's those that we think are secreting the gel.
Okay. If you have the gel, do you think that there is not geographic distribution of the parasite? I mean, where are the metacytes in the gel? Where are the leptomonas or something like that? Because the gel can stick together, but some ones are producing the gel, some ones are not producing, they need to get out. How this?
So the question is whether there's any variation in the location of parasites in respect to the gel. So we published this some years ago in the 2002 paper. And what you see is that the forms produced in the gel are concentrated in the middle, and the metacyclics are found at the poles. Interestingly, both at the front and the back end of the plug. So the guys at the back end are obviously in a very poor position because they're at the wrong end. But the ones at the front pole are literally in the pole position for transmission.
Yes. Okay. I know the publication, but I just like to confirm.
Yeah.
That's what happens. Any other questions?
Well, we showed that this chitinase overexpresses arrive to stomatal valve earlier. Is it possible to explain this by faster development or more quick division of parasites? What about the development in vitro? Are these overexpressors developed better in vitro?
So there's no difference in development in vitro of the overexpressors versus the controls. What you say is true. I mean, it could be possible that, of course, in vivo is not the same as in vitro. There may be a component of accelerated parasite development, but we've no data to support that.
We have no more time for questions right now. We'll have a break. Please return at 25 after the hour, and we'll have the remaining four presenters following. Thank you.